Okay, this is Julian Valdivia with the Sam Proctor Oral History Program. I'm sitting today at the Lee County Black History Society in Roberto Clemente Park, speaking with...
Ronald Davis from Fort Myers, Florida.
All right, Ron, thank you for speaking with me today. The first thing I want to ask for the ease of the transcriber is, how do you spell your name?
R-O-N-A-L-D. My middle name is Earl, E-A-R-L. My last name is Davis, D-A-V-I-S.
Okay, perfect. And where were you born and what year was it?
Born in 1947 in Evansville, Indiana.
Okay. And can you tell me about growing up, like who your parents were? Did you have siblings?
Yeah. We lived in southern Indiana, which is basically right across the Ohio River from Kentucky.
Mm.
And I was born in Evansville, and my dad worked for the telephone company, and we lived in southern Indiana. And on my mother and father were both born in southern Indiana, and they went to high school together. My father dated my mother's sister, and when they went away in 1941, they both graduated from high school the same night. They were in the same high school. 26 kids graduated. My father stood next to my mother, and he told me they were secretly holding hands. I looked at the picture, and I looked, even though they weren't girlfriend and boyfriend. But in June of 41, my dad and mother graduated from high school. Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and Fort in December of 41. My dad was drafted before he'd been out of high school a year. And my mother joined the Waves in the Navy.
Okay.
And so she became a secretary and worked in Washington, D.C. And my dad went into the Army Air Corps, and he worked in the communications, where he learned a lot about telephone systems and radios. And he came out, he went to work with a company that was installing radio telephone systems all around southern Indiana.
Oh, wow.
And then my mother had trouble with sinuses, and so they went on a vacation. I guess I was in third grade. And they came down here. They went to Florida, and they visited some friends on the East Coast. And then my dad didn't like it on the East Coast. It came across over to the West Coast. And the way the family story goes is I was with him. My two younger brothers were up there with my grandparents. He said, if I can get a job here, I'm going to move here. Mm. And asked him about that several times, and each time he told me a little bit more about it. But I don't want to go into too much detail because it would take a long time. But to make a long story short, he went to Liggett's drugstore downtown. He asked the waitress, who's in charge, where's the local telephone company? She says, we're in luck. It's on the building behind us. So my dad said, well, we'll go ahead and order. And then we went ahead and ate lunch, and my mother and I sat there.
Mm.
And he went back and talked to him, and when he came back, he had a job. They said, when can you report? They wanted him in 2 weeks. And he says, no, I can't be here until like November. So we had to go sell a house and pack up and get down here. So the availability of job and homes and a climate that was hopefully helpful to my mother's health was what brought us here. And I consider us to be immigrants.
Mm.
We moved from what is the southern part of the northern part. It's right across the line from Kentucky.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some Kentuckians fought for the north, some fought for the south in the Civil War. But people in southern Indiana sounded like and acted like and behaved a lot like people from Kentucky.
Mm.
And, you know, a lot of people from southern Indiana came from Kentucky, like Abraham Lincoln's family moved from Kentucky to southern Indiana, went through Vincennes and on later on to Illinois. But that's the area that I'm from. When I got down to Fort Myers, got into school and went to Edgewood Elementary School, my dad worked for the phone company. My mother eventually started, she became a secretary for Riverside Baptist Church. My dad spent his whole career down here in Florida with the same company, and my mother worked for the church for 22 years. And we walked to school I have a lot of memories, a lot of things I know you want to talk about education. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you. And I know you want to know how the picture is, but I consider myself to be an immigrant coming to a place that had a different kind of culture than I was used to. We lived up north in a rural area, we could only see one house from where we were. We were out in the country, and my dad drove in the city to work. My mother stayed home with me and my two brothers. Mm. We moved down here. We were in suburbia in East Fort Myers, and we walked about 3/4 of a mile to school. And right down Edgewood Avenue to Edgewood Elementary School.
Oh, wow. Okay. So in essence, did you and you do have siblings, correct?
I have two younger brothers. I'm the oldest of three.
Okay. Did you and your siblings enjoy the move to Fort Myers, or did you want to stay in southern Indiana?
No, I didn't want to. I was so young. I mean, you know, I lived out in the country anyhow, so I didn't really have neighbors, the little friends that I played with and everything. We were happy. It was okay moving to Florida. You know, didn't have a problem. It wasn't like we were in high school or middle school and you had those connections over multiple years.
Mm. And what was it like?
Okay, what we did give up, though, is we gave up being close to our extended family.
Oh, okay.
My mother's family, my father's family were all from southern Indiana, and every summer when my dad got a 2 weeks vacation, we would always go back home. And so most of my cousins weren't there. I had like 60 cousins. My mother was one of 9 kids, and she was the oldest, you know, the oldest woman. So, you know, I had lots of younger cousins. I was the third oldest one.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a reunion, and they all tried to get back every other year. But we always looked forward to our summer vacations because, I mean, we weren't going anywhere. We knew where we were going every year, and it was a good experience. But we did give up that those relationships with our family, where you would go to dinner every Sunday evening or once a month or birthdays or all that. It did have an effect on that. That's why I do consider myself an immigrant. Even though I immigrated within the United States, it's a long way. And if you were in Europe, you'd be in a different country if you went that far.
Mm. I want to ask about like the trip down to Southwest Florida. Like how did you make that trip? Was it by car and then you took the highway system? Or I don't even think we had the highway system yet.
I-75 was not done. We came down 41. 41 actually goes right through Evansville.
Mm.
But it was a 2-day trip and not a 1-day trip. And I mean, I was pretty young, so I don't remember exactly how we got down here. But I do know that when we came down here for the move, my dad, we didn't have the furniture. We drove down here in his car. And our furniture came down like a month later.
Oh, wow.
And so my dad had called my grandfather, his dad, and he loaned him money to make a down payment on the house. And we didn't have any furniture. So the people that he worked with loaned him furniture. And I remember this really well. We had, I slept on a cot, like an army cot with the wood on each side and the canvas. And in the living room for tables, we had cardboard boxes.
Oh, wow.
So some people loaned us some lamps and loaned us some chairs. And we basically were kind of camping out, I guess you could say, for a couple months. And I still remember how excited my mother got when our furniture finally arrived. She knew the furniture was coming that day, that morning, in fact. And she put me out in the front yard to watch for the big Mayflower furniture or moving van truck that was coming in. And so when I saw the truck come down one road, it was supposed to had to turn right to come to our house, but it turned left, went the other way. Mm. And I never saw my mother run before. I've never seen my mother run out in the yard and go, hey, and I'm just a little guy like this, you know. So I knew she was real excited about getting our furniture.
And when you moved here, were a lot of the neighbors and things like that, were they also people who came from the north, or were they locals?
Well, there were some older people that were, had been there for a while. There were retired people. There were people who had, I don't know exactly where they came from, but they were recent arrivals too. That whole subdivision was made up of new homes, and a lot of homes were under construction. Mm. Like on both sides of us, there was no houses, but and then in a year or two, there were.
Yeah.
And pretty much the whole place filled up. But when we moved there, wasn't that many of them.
Okay. And you went to Edgewood Elementary, you said?
Yes, Edgewood Elementary School.
Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah. It was an old school. And when I say old, it was made out of brick. It had, I remember a lot of detail about it. It was the kind of school that was two stories. And the upper grades were up on the higher stories. It had wood floors. It had wooden window sashes. It had windows that you had to lift up like this. And it had wood, whatever you call them there, though, on the, where you open the windows up and then there's like a plate you can lean out like
yeah.
that. Okay, there was no screens on it or anything. I remember seeing the ant. I remember taking a magnifying glass and trying to chase ants around on that. And but that there was no air conditioning or anything like that. It was just an old style school with stairs on each side and an auditorium that went back. And then there was a separate building for lunch.
Okay. Do you remember how many students were in your class?
Actually, I think I may have a picture.
Oh, okay.
Of one of my classes. I'm not sure which one it is, but we do have one of my brother's class, I know. But ironically, when I came back to work here as a math teacher, the guy that was my sixth grade teacher was the superintendent of schools. And Ray Podorf was his name.
Okay.
And
What was his name again?
Ray Podorf.
Okay.
And I told some, when we had this meeting with new teachers at the beginning of the school year, I reintroduced myself. Said, I already know who you are. You probably don't know who I am. But I told him who I was. And I said, I was in your sixth grade class at Edgewood Elementary School when you were a teacher there. He goes, oh, no. And I told everybody a couple of stories, but. Yeah, it was a very small community at the time. You could get anywhere in 15 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I was kind of curious because, you're the first person I've interviewed from out of Dunbar. And I want to know, was there any kind of, like, interaction with, like, the black community here beyond... I mean, I know people, like, went to, like, work, like, in downtown Fort Myers and stuff like that, like, as, like, repairmen, domestics and stuff like that, but...
The first time I ever remember actually having a conversation with a black person was at Edgewood Elementary School.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember what grade it was, but my teacher sent me to the custodian to get something. I think maybe an eraser. Or the new eraser or something. But he sent me to his office, and his office was in the back of the auditorium. Mm. The reason I remember this so well is because when I got to his office, it smelled like cigar smoke. And it reminded me of my grandfather. My grandfather was a cigar smoker. And when I, got there, I could smell it as I was getting close to the room, but when I got in there, it was a black person. I just remember just looking.
Yeah.
That was the first time I had, because we were in segregated schools. Mm. There wasn't anybody that around that I had encountered riding my bicycle or in my neighborhood. Or I can't even remember anybody in stores that was black. But I remember that was the first time I spoke to him. I told him what the teacher wanted. But I guess there was a pad that was written down or something, and he gave me what I needed, and I left. But I remembered that, and what made it stick out of my mind was that cigar smell.
Mm. Okay. And so I want to ask them, where did you go to middle school as well, or to a junior high school?
Didn't have middle schools in. It was junior high. Lee Junior High opened in 1959 with seventh graders, and I was there.
Okay.
I later became principal of that school. Same school, same building. And they tore that building down and replaced with a new building while I was the principal there. It's now James Stevens Middle School. Used to be Lee. Or no, it's a K-8, James Stevens K-8. It's not far from here.
Okay.
But it was Lee Middle School, Lee Junior High. But when I became the principal of school, it had changed to middle school. But it was 7, 8, and 9. The years that I was there, they didn't have enough room in the high school. They were building a new high school. So we had to stay there for 10th grade.
Mm.
They had portables, put a bunch of portables out in back of the place.
Oh, Lord.
Some of them are still there, I think. No, they weren't the same ones, but still. Yeah, it was I'm a part of the front end of the baby boomer generation.
Mm.
And every stage of my life that I go through, including the one I'm in now, we're like a bulge. You know, there's like this many before us and this many after us, but when we go through, there's like this many. Because everybody that went away to war came back and started getting married and having children and having, you know, quite a few of them. And so we're part of the baby boomer generation. So there wasn't enough schools. It's like there won't be enough doctors when we need our health care. You know, that, you know, there probably won't be enough space in the graveyards. I don't know how that's gonna work. But I'm in this big bulge of population that have the same needs. When there was an acute housing shortage after World War II was over, everybody came back. People got married, moved out, and they needed homes.
Mm.
And so anything that, you know, had a roof on it, I guess, could be a home maybe for more than one group of people until it's just, you know, started building. And when that happens, the community began to expand in terms of its amount of work it was doing, more salaries, better salaries, more roads, more telephones. It was expanding the gross national product of the whole United States, but in Lee County, it was growing like crazy because so many people were moving here.
Yeah.
But even then, I mean, the pace was fast, but it wasn't nearly as fast as it became later.
Mm.
And then after air conditioning, when I went away to college, when I went away, after I was gone, my parents got air conditioning. And a color television. I said, you guys couldn't wait for me to leave so you could get a color TV and an air conditioning in the house.
And so, actually, because you're a UF alumni, what year did you end up going to UF?
I went to, that's another thing that Florida did. There wasn't enough college space, so they started a community college. Actually, it was called a junior college it was a whole new class of schools in the state that was intended to give every child in the state of Florida an opportunity to drive to higher education after high school.
Mm.
Basically, they didn't have enough seats at the University of Florida and Florida State and all the other colleges to take care of all the kids that were graduating that wanted to go to college.
Oh, wow.
And so there was junior colleges built everywhere. And in Lee County, it was called Edison Junior College, and the first classes were held in downtown Fort Myers at the Gwynn Building. If you're familiar with the old Gwynn Building, it's still there. It's next to the First Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And that's where it started. They started having classes. They built a campus out where the college is now. It's called Florida Southwestern.
Yeah.
That initially was started as Edison Junior College, became Edison Community College, then it became Edison State, and now it's something else.
It's still Edison to most people here.
Yeah, it's still Edison, yeah. And within, you could only go for 2 years. You got a junior college degree.
Yeah.
And then, but that gave you the right to go to any college of any university in Florida that you wanted to.
Okay.
And so my dad and I, we went on this tour, and we went to South Florida, which was University of South Florida in Tampa at that time, was three buildings surrounded by cows.
Mm.
And I didn't want to go there. It was smaller than Edison. And we kept on going. We went to Gainesville. And then I said, this is where I want to go to school. And that's where I went.
What was the appeal of Gainesville for you?
Well, it looked like what I believed a college should look like. First of all, it was old. It had red brick buildings, mostly. It had ivy growing up the side of the buildings. It was a country. I mean, it wasn't a big city. It was still rural. I considered it to be rural, but it was long time, had long time been established. And it had a well-known program for what I wanted to do at the time. I wanted to go into engineering.
Mm.
And I went into electrical engineering. And I still had a couple of courses I needed to take to get fully admitted, because you have to, certain prerequisites you have to have before you can, you know, get into the program. And then I decided to change to mathematics, because there was two things that I did well when I was in high school. I was an above average student, but not a genius. That was math and music.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really good at math. I was in all the top classes, and I was first year. I played trombone, and I loved singing in the choir at church and playing my instrument and all that. So I was a musician. And a mathematician, two M's.
And so that's how you ended up, I guess that's what influenced you to become a math teacher later on then.
Well, it's actually a longer story than that, because the Vietnam War intervened.
Oh, okay.
I was of draft age. When I was getting ready to graduate from Florida in 68, I called my draft board, and they told me that I would... I'd been offered a fellowship to stay with the school and pursue my master's degree in what is now called a computer science.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was called back then, computer science. We used IBM punch cards. We had calculators that cost a lot of money, that all they did was four functions, wouldn't even take square roots. The big, that was on the ground floor of computers, and our math teachers, professors tried to encourage us to go into that, because they wanted to build that department, and what better place to get people to do that than from the math department. So that's what I was going to do. But when I contacted my draft board, they said, I have to know the lady who was in charge of the draft board here.
Yeah.
And she said that if you accept that fellowship, we're going to draft you by November. And so I said, well, what are my options? This was going into my senior year, so I wasn't sure what I was going to do.
Yeah.
But I was only going to have that year of 4F, then I had to give it up. That was a deferment, college deferment.
Mm-hmm.
So she said... you can join one of the other services. You can join like the Air Force or the Navy, or you can join, or you can get an occupational deferment. I didn't know what an occupational deferment was. She explained to me it's like working for in a defense-related business or a factory or something that the government highly values what you're doing as part of the defense effort. Then you can be deferred for another year. And so she said they give deferments to math and science teachers. And this came about as part of this race to Sputnik, where they wanted to get math and science and engineering and all that pumped up and get people into it.
Yeah.
And that went all the way back to new math and getting the kids in school taught by certified teachers who knew a little bit about math and a little bit about science. And so I went and took all the Air Force tests and physical and everything, And I passed everything. They called me in and said, "Well, you know, got good news for you." I didn't want to fly.
Yeah.
I thought of myself as good with managing things, controlling things. And I'd worked in a grocery store, which is a whole other story. And I thought I'd be good in logistics, organizing things, getting people to do things. And they made me take the flight test. Mm. Well, while we were taking the flight test, the guy that was given the test, he gave out some answers. He said things like, "I guess all of you put A to on number 7, and he did that on 4 or 5 of them. And later on, I started thinking, you know, I don't really know as much as they think I know. And so if I get in there and then I wash out, then I might end up being a machine gunner on the side of a Huey helicopter."
Yeah.
And I said, "You know what? I'm not so sure I want to do that." Mm-hmm. So I went, this all happened about the same time after I got the information about my task force. So I said, "Well, let's look at, you know, an occupational affirmative." Well, I went down to the student union, and they had, at the time, they had a career placement office there down the bottom floor. And as I was walking down the hallway, there was a big bulletin board. And on that bulletin board, as clear as day I can remember, there was 1 3x5 card with a thumbtack in it. It was sitting like this. And it said, "Middle school math teacher, Bradford County Middle School." There was a phone number.
Hmm.
The middle school was looking for a math teacher to start the new school year.
Yeah.
And I cut off my hair. It wasn't that bad, but I went down and bought a tie and a jacket and interviewed and got the job. I spent the rest of my career as an educator.
Mm.
And that's how I got in. My mother had wanted me to be a church youth director, singing, directing the choir, working with young people in the church. You know, she was, my whole family was deeply involved in the Southern Baptist religion.
Mm.
And every time the door opened, me and my two brothers were there because, you know, my mother worked there.
Yeah.
And my dad was a deacon, and he ran the TV station and then the radio station and all that. They were deeply involved in it. So my mother knew that I had some talent for working with kids, but she wanted me to do it along the religious lines. Turns out I did have talent for working with kids. And after I'd been a teacher for just a few months, I knew that this is what I was going to do.
Mm.
And so I still wanted to get my master's degree, and I ended up moving to Maryland and got my master's degree at University of Maryland in math. And then I moved back down to Fort Myers and started teaching at Riverdale.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so what year did you start teaching in Fort Myers then?
In 1977, 77, oh. 78 school year.
Okay. And so that's when I remember, because we were talking with Carl Burnside, the thing is the principal at Dunbar High now.
Yeah, he's a Noel, you know.
Yeah, I do know. But is that around, because you didn't immediately become an administrator.
No, I had been a teacher by then for 6 years, 1 year in Bradford County Middle School, and then 5 years in Maryland while I was getting my master's degree. You know, not that many places let you get a master's degree in math, straight math. You can get in math ed, but straight math you can't. Mm-hmm. And I still wanted to get my degree in straight math. I ended up, going ahead and doing it in education. It was what would benefit me. For one thing, I didn't have a certificate.
Yeah.
You couldn't just know a lot about math. You had to know how to teach it, too. Or at least be able to convince other people that you knew how to teach it. There is a big difference between knowing it and being able to teach it to somebody. So, yeah, and when I moved down here, I went to Riverdale, which is where my brother had attended as a high school. My youngest brother had gone to high school there. And so people knew me people knew my mother from the church, and I became involved in the school, deeply involved in the school right on. Mm-hmm. I was finding math teachers today is a hard thing to do, probably harder today. And so they were happy to have an experienced teacher, you know, somebody with 5 or 6 years of experience.
Yeah. And so
and a master's degree.
I'm assuming because like normally like, I mean, by that time, like everything had already been integrated in Fort Myers and integration was like a shock in Fort Myers. But since you had been to, I mean, I believe by 68, when you went up to UF, things were already integrated at UF. There were black students there.
Yeah, there were. And when I taught my first year at Bradford County Middle School, that was the first year they integrated.
Oh, okay.
So I never taught in segregated schools. I was a student in segregated schools, but I didn't teach. In fact, when I went to Edison, there was a few black kids. I remember one kid in our, he sang, had him in two classes. He was singing in our choir. I sang in the choir at Edison and also in PE. Mm-hmm. So that was really the first time I came in contact as a student with a fellow student that was black. And there was just one, and he was a pastor, mm-hmm. a local pastor. I didn't get to know him that well, but the reason he sticks out of my mind is because he could sing so well. And I, you know, we were in the choir together.
So I wanted to ask then about you teaching and things like that. What were a lot of the struggles for, or I guess what were a lot of the challenges in the school system at the time in 77 when you were here in Fort Myers? What were they trying to focus on?
Can I tell you a funny story about Bradford County Middle School?
It's
along those same lines, because that was a year they were integrated. They built a whole new school, a middle school with no walls, open space concept. I don't know if you've heard of that or not.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, it's a failure, but there we were. We had this, I'd say about a third of the kids were black and about two-thirds were white, somewhere around there. And these kids were not used, they had not been integrated before. Mm. And yeah, I thought it came off really, really well as, you know, being a teacher in the situation, but and not having been in the other situation, I don't know what it was like. Maybe a whole lot better, maybe a whole lot worse, I don't know. But the kids seemed to adjust to it a lot easier than the adults did. Mm. We had this one kid who was, he just wouldn't shut up. He just loved to talk and loved to play, loved to aggravate people. And so he would happen to be the son of the local sheriff. And so we put him, or police, maybe the city, I don't know, it was the local county sheriff or the city police, one or the other. And, so we kept moving him around, trying to put him in different places where he wouldn't talk. And so finally we put him between two black girls.
Oh.
And we thought it worked out pretty good. He didn't get in that much trouble. But we got called in to change his seating because his father had complained to the principal where he was seated. Mm. Didn't like where he was seated. So we did. We moved him. That was really the only thing that I can recall that was overtly racial.
Yeah.
I do remember back in those days we paddled kids. And I didn't want to paddle kids. Later, as an assistant principal, I paddled a lot of kids because that was part of the job description.
Yeah.
But their teachers had to do it. And I remember not wanting to paddle kids at all, but finally doing it because we had to get in, follow the rules because they were accustomed to it.
Yeah, corporal punishment was like the thing.
Yep. I remember we had this kid named Elijah Ganey, and he was kind of a black kid, and he was slight, but he could do some interesting things. He'd walk in his hands and some other athletic kinds of things that, you know, would be silly.
Yeah.
But he also liked to act up and talk when he wasn't supposed to and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching we had to have, when you paddle somebody, you had to have a witness. And I remember witnessing this kid get paddled by another teacher who was a white teacher who lived there. He wasn't from the college that drove there every day. He was from the community.
Yeah.
And I remember watching him paddle that kid, and I remember tearing up because of the way he did it. It was brutal, absolutely brutal. But that was an anomaly. I don't know why it happened that way. But those are the only two incidents that I can think of that had anything to do with racial issues.
It sounds about right during that time, because, I mean, like, the general consensus from what I've got, it's like you said, there were more problems with the adults than the actual kids. And the only stories I've gotten that were, like, really bad between students were, like, I mean, by the time that kids in the high schools, which is when, you know, kids start to get, like, more politically active and things like that. But, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Especially, I was going to ask, too, with that story with the teacher, because it seemed to, was that teacher, like, older, or were they?
Oh, it had been around for a while, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember hearing a similar, well, not a, it's not a similar story, but LaVon Sims, the city councilman who I had spoken with, he was a teacher at North Fort Myers High. And it was, similar in the sense that a lot of the older teachers who had been around for a bit were, like, openly hostile towards a lot of the black students and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Having said all that, I was actually interested, since you were in the school system and things like that, I always wondered, with Dunbar High and things like that, after they had closed it, did the city ever use the building for anything else afterwards? I know it was like a junior high for a bit, or no?
Well, let me tell you, my junior senior year when I went to Fort Myers High.
Yeah.
They bused me right down what is now called MLK.
Yeah, Anderson.
What's called Anderson Avenue. And they bused me right down Anderson Avenue, right to Fort Myers High from East Fort Myers, right past the black school, what was the black school then. And I was out of school. I was graduated in 65, so I was out of school when they were actually, when it was actually integrated.
Yeah.
They built a new school. That's where Dunbar is now, the Dunbar High School is now, which has
been the one on Edison.
It's been converted into, it's been remodeled and expanded into a big high school.
Yeah.
But it was a very small school. My daughter actually went to Dunbar Middle School when it was a middle school.
Oh, wow.
That location. They built that school to try to delay segregation, or to say separate but equal. Look, we built them a new school, brand new school. Because when you look at Dunbar High School, the old Dunbar High School, and the Fort Myers High School, they didn't compare. But when you built, you then took the new school they just built for the high to be a new Dunbar High School.
Yeah,
it was better than Fort Myers High.
Mm.
So they were, you know, trying to claim that, well, look, separate but equal. Look, it still works. They got a better school than what we have over here.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they weren't gonna get away with it. But they tried to do it.
I'm interested, kind of like, because when we talk about like integration and stuff like that, we normally stop at like things are integrated, and then there's like that missing part of like, well, what happens after. Living here in Fort Myers after things were integrated, what were some of the issues that were like kind of like the same between like Dunbar and like, well, both sides of the rail tracks, I should say?
Well, let me go back to a couple of the significant things that I think we can have been left out. First one is when my mother was first started to work, and she had three boys, we had a black lady who came in and cleaned our house.
Domestic, yeah.
Domestic. And the black men picked up our trash. Mm-hmm. They didn't pick it up from the street. They went behind your house where you had to, you put it, and they would dump it into their own big cans, and then they would carry it out to the front and put it in a truck.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, would come into your neighborhood and do domestic things. But the rule was that they couldn't be over there after dark. And there was a, you probably heard this already, there was a train track.
Yeah.
They have to be on one side of the track. I never encountered that, but I knew that was a rule. After I started driving, I had dates with my first wife lived over. I could drive around this way through Fort Myers to get to her, or I could go through this way, which took me across the railroad track, down Anderson Avenue, part of the way down Ford Street, down Edison, Hanson, and over in that way. And so I was going through different part of town, sometimes like 11:30 at night. And so I never got worried or never got nervous. It did, you know, it didn't scare me or bother me, but had somebody that was black tried to do that on the other side of town,
yeah,
I suspect there would have been problems of some kind.
Mm.
My other thing I'm going to tell you about is has to do with the jobs. I worked at the Winn-Dixie downtown. It's not there anymore. The Henry Street Winn-Dixie in downtown. Have you heard about that?
I haven't. I don't know a lot about the grocery stores and things like that.
Well, it's where the city. It's a city building now. The Lee Theater.
Okay. Yeah.
The Lee Theater was on the same block. So it was Anderson Avenue, Henry Street, Mason's Bakery was over here.
Okay.
Whole block was a Lee Theater, and the Winn-Dixie was right there.
Yeah, Anderson and Henry, I know that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I worked at that Winn-Dixie when I was in high school and junior college. And there were no black employees there. They were all white people.
Yeah.
And most of the people that worked there were Fort Myers High guys that I knew, because you know somebody, hey, you want a job, come work over here. And then it's kind of a click, I guess you'd say. Well, I remember a black girl, I came to work one day. She was sitting on the sugar stack of sugar, 5-pound bags come in, 12, I think it's 12 to a thing, and they stack them up. She was sitting there taking a test. First of all, I'd never seen a black girl in the back of the room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like an employee, or she was taking an employment test. She was going to try to work there.
Yeah.
And so I started talking to her, and she was pretty too.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that right away. And I said, what kind of test is this? She says, it's a math test. And I go, oh, math test. I love this stuff. So, We went through the questions, and I helped her a little bit, maybe.
Yeah.
I helped her. And then I never saw her again. But the manager, a couple of weeks later, the manager came up to me in the back room and said, I forget what her name was, said, did you help so-and-so with her test that she was taking back here? And I said, what test? What are you talking about?
Did they normally have?
So I think tests? No, I didn't take a test.
Uh-huh.
Nobody I knew took a test. There were no tests.
Yeah.
But she had to take a test, and she probably would have done just fine. But me being like I am,
yeah.
There's a pretty girl. I'm going to talk to her. Yeah, maybe if I get a job here, then I'll get to know her a little bit, you know,
because yeah.
I didn't grow up in a segregationist family.
Yeah.
We're from Indiana, and, I was looking forward to, getting to know her. And apparently she worked for a couple of weeks, and then she ended up not working anymore. And it may be that she just wasn't good enough to, with the math, to stay in the job. Because back then, you had a different kind of cash register. It didn't do all the work for you.
Yeah. So then, talking about that then, hold on, I'm trying to remember what it was. Okay, weird thing. Do you know anything about, like, the housing prices around here? Because interesting story that I've learned about. I think I might have told you about it before when we were talking earlier about how I'd heard that some of the houses like around Dunbar and like in the black community were about just as much as they were basically like off like McGregor and stuff like that. Was there, do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about that.
Okay. I was just wondering because it's one thing that I'm just trying to like feel around.
That they were overpriced? That house were overpriced?
Yeah, I think it had to do with like supply issues because it was the only area where
you're limited to where, yeah.
And so there wasn't a lot of housing there to begin with. And it's also like the biggest black community between Tampa and Miami. So you've got a really big population of people all looking for good housing. And there's only a small area where you can get it. So I think that drove up prices. But I don't know, like, any – I mean, I don't even know where I can get the numbers on it. I was just – I'm just trying to see if there are people that know about it.
Well, there's probably a lot of rental housing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know who owned it or how that worked. But in the 70s and 80s, the communities began to change. I mean, where I grew up now is all there's probably still some white people in there, but there's not very many. My dad lived in an area that it was actually on the river, on a canal. There were white people on the canals, but as soon as you got one block off, it was all black and Hispanic from there over.
Mm-hmm.
So the waterfront property still is valued higher, and I guess people don't mind living in living in areas like that if they can have be on the water, but the rest of the community is very different.
Yeah.
Palm Beach Boulevard, when you drive along there, now it's all, I mean, there's a lot of Hispanic businesses. There's still white businesses along there, too.
Mm.
But it's a very, very different neighborhood than the one I grew up in.
Did that happen over time as, like, more immigration happened? Because I know, like, during, like, the 80s and 90s, I mean, even now, we started getting a lot more immigration from, like, Latin America and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of large Cuban population, Mexican population. After I became a principal, I hired people who moved over from the East Coast. They have been in America for a long time. They're citizens, but they didn't. The East Coast was so expensive, they wanted to move over here. And I hired quite a few people like that. In fact, some of them, they would buy a house like in Lehigh and set up their family there, but then the guy who was a main breadwinner would stay in Miami and rent something small, like, I don't know, a room or how they did it. But then he would come over every Friday, you know, spend the weekends with his family and then go back over.
Yeah.
They could make money there, but everything was so expensive it didn't go that far.
Mm. So when, how long were you a principal then?
25 years.
Okay. And then I remember you were talking, I mean, I don't really know about, like, the big immigration spike, but, like, when was, like, the big spike in people around here?
There was a time when we were opening four brand new schools every year.
Mm.
And I would say about late maybe 90s, mid-90s, up to about 2005,
yeah.
2004, about a decade there, they were adding one school after another. When I lived here, as a high school kid, there was one high school, Fort Myers High. There, Alma had a small high school out there, too, with like 13 seniors, and I mean, then they closed it down when they built Riverdale.
Mm.
But by the time I graduated, North had a graduating class, so then there was two high schools. Then came Cypress, and of course now there's 13 of them.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering because I didn't know if there was like a dynamic where they had like a teacher shortage or like a shortage of like. A shortage of, like, people to, like, work at the schools. Because I was wondering, with, like, all the people coming and all the schools being opened, I mean, like, you need, like, manpower for that.
No, you're exactly right. I was on a recruiting team, and there are still recruiting teams that go out. to try to recruit teachers to come. If we don't grow enough teachers in Florida, mm-hmm. we certainly don't grow enough in Lee County. So they have to bring them in. And, you know, I've hired many teachers that way. I've had people come from Indiana. They can't get a job up there. They apply to the local, and they're cutting teachers, so they come down here and they work for 4 or 5 years and wait for an opening to happen back up in their home where their family is, then they transfer up there.
Yeah.
East Lee County High School was filled with people like that, and they, over the period of 3 or 4 years, most of the ones that we recruited down here left, mm-hmm. went back.
Wow.
What happens is you end up with inexperienced young teachers right out of college, and then by the time they get some experience and know how to do things and get good, they leave.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, is like pay a big part of that and things like that? Because
pay in Florida is a lot lower, but I think for the most part, it probably has to do with being around your family.
Mm.
Being where you want to be, and then just taking a job because you can't get where you want to be, but you still can do the job and get paid and begin your career and then hopefully transfer back later on.
Yeah. I want to ask actually in like regards to that. I know like you left in 68, but there was a teacher strike in 68 because of, because they had to they still had to pay for their own supplies and because wages were low. Was there ever any kind of organization by teachers afterwards?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, of course, 68 was when I graduated from college.
Mm.
And started teaching at Bradford County Middle School. And that was the first year that they had a teacher union. Of course, it was called an association, not a union. And I remember I wasn't a part of it, but somebody on my team was a part of it. And she told us that the superintendent said, here's how much money you have more than you had last year. Let's decide how we're going to use it. In other words, they didn't really negotiate away. In other words, he set his priorities and then said, okay, there's this much money that I'm willing to let you guys negotiate, because this is a little county, and so it wasn't like something big.
Yeah.
But later on, I did serve as a rep, and I got a little bit involved in it, and I got much more deeply involved than it was when I was a principal.
Mm.
I was on some of the teams that negotiated the contract, negotiating teams.
And would you negotiate with the cities and the counties and things like that?
No, you have the administrative team, the Lee County administrative team, and then you have the teacher association, and you have the support personnel. They have a union too,
mm.
so you have to negotiate with them.
Okay, after 68, were there any kind of strikes or protests or things like that because of it?
No, you know why? It's because when they wrote the law, and it still exists to this day, if you're convicted of going on strike in Florida and you're a member of the teacher union, they can kick you out of the union and take your FRS retirement.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's why we don't have
That's why you don't have strikes.
See, I was wondering, too, this year, but I remember thinking when the strikes were happening, I think it was in West Virginia and Arizona.
Oh, yeah, this year there's three states that did it.
Yeah. I was thinking because I had always heard, Florida was one of the ones towards, the bottom in terms of, teacher pay.
47th, yeah.
Yeah, right, and I was wondering, why aren't things exploding here? Because I'm like, if it's happening up there, it's not like teachers aren't organized here. I'm like, I wonder what's keeping them from doing that,
but I didn't know. It's the law.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, this is not a union-friendly state, and the laws that they have control public employees pretty significantly.
Okay. Well, that's actually definitely pretty important, I guess, in the context of thinking about things with, education and stuff like that, because in regards to the black teachers too, I remember when things like that happened, there was the added thing of there was the pressure of where they didn't want to lose their jobs as well, because they kind of understood that it was kind of like the nice.
Well, they basically they had to risk everything.
Yeah.
Not just the black teachers, but the white teachers too, because they fired them. The ones that went out on strike, they fired them. And then when they, after the strike was settled, they still needed teachers. So they rehired them, but they made them pay a fee.
Oh, wow.
To be rehired.
Okay.
That's what they did. So you think about if you got a school system and you've, and say there's 300 teachers and 100 of them walk out, and then what are you going to do to fill those 100 slots every day?
Yeah.
Who do you put in there to manage those kids day after day? And what is the quality of education that they're getting? You need 100 teachers really fast when that thing is over. So they just hired the same ones back, but they punished them by making them pay like $500, which is 6,000, what is it, 1/12, about 8% of their salary.
Yeah, and I mean, $500 back then was hefty.
Yeah, they'd let you pay it in installments.
Mm-hmm. How generous.
So whatever you got, they took,
yeah,
basically.
Okay, well, we've been talking for close to an hour now.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I think it'll cut it off there. Yeah.